Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The war between moose and ticks is not going well for the moose, and from an evolutionary perspective, it could be centuries before these two species strike a balance of power. Biologist Dr. Bill Samuel talks about his research on winter ticks. And greenhouse gas solutions. A visit to the recent conference sponsored by the Petroleum Technology Alliance of Canada and Climate Change Central showcased a number of companies and their efforts to curb greenhouse gas emissions. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Unlike the Loch Ness Monster, the ghost moose really does exist. And sightings were particularly frequent this past winter. The cause is a little tick called the winter tick, and an infected moose gets so itchy, the animal rubs off all of its outer coat trying to rid itself of the ticks. This leaves a moose that looks rather ghoulish in appearance. Biologist Dr. Bill Samuel presented his findings on winter ticks and moose to the Canadian Society of Zoologists at a recent meeting at the University of Lethbridge.
Well, ticks are ticks, and we don't have that many species of ticks in Canada, about 40, and we don't have many species of ticks in Alberta, just a few. Most people are familiar with the tick we get when we're hiking in the mountains in the spring. The winter tick is related to that Rocky Mountain wood tick, but it's not a human tick. And the winter tick is a tick that climbs on actually members of the deer family, primarily in Alberta, but also horses and cattle. So it primarily infests moose, elk, and deer, horses and cattle in Alberta. And it's an unusual tick in that all the stages that take blood, and there's three stages, a larvae, a nymph, and an adult. And all three stages that take blood live on the same individual animal over winter. So if a moose gets infested with winter ticks, those ticks all feed three times on that moose. So it's the only one host tick in Canada. It's a very unusual tick in that regard.
What does it do? Like, when you see pictures of moose that have been infested, they practically have no hair left.
Where people have moose, they're well acquainted with what we call in the spring ghost moose. And a ghost moose is an animal that has started to fight ticks in March and April by grooming them. They get thousands of ticks all feeding on them at one time, and so they get this huge sensation of itch caused by tick bite, massive tick biting. And they, in response, they groom, and they lick, they bite, they chew, they scratch with their hind foot. They rub against vegetation, trees, and logs, trying to rid themselves of this tick infestation. And when they do that, they damage and break off much of their hair coat. And although the moose hair coat looks dark, looks brown and black, if you break that off down at its base, it's actually gray in color. So when they remove most of their hair coat, they actually look like ghosts, and hence the popular expression in Alberta and elsewhere in Western Canada, ghost moose.
Now, why would that happen to the moose and not other animals like deer?
Well, I think it's a function of the number of ticks. They ambush the animals from the vegetation in the autumn. And the young stages of ticks form on the vegetation, and when the moose or elk or deer pass by, or horses or cattle, when they pass by, then these ticks literally grab a ride and they start feeding on the animals. When these small little larvae, very young stages of ticks, get on a host in the fall, when they get on a deer in the fall, the first thing the deer does is turn around and lick them off. So the deer are well adapted to sensing when they become infected. And in return, they groom the tick very early before it takes much of a blood meal. So they're well adapted to controlling the numbers of ticks very early on. When the young ticks climb on moose in the fall, moose do nothing. They do not seem to recognize that they're being infested. And as a result, over autumn, they can get in bad tick years, as we had this past year actually, they can become massively infested with ticks. And they don't seem to recognize they have a problem until these larger stages, the later life stages, these nymphs and adults, which take lots of blood in February, March, and April. That's when the moose start to respond. Essentially, they're responding much too late to do them much good.
I was amazed at the slide you showed in your presentation at the number of ticks that are on moose compared to other animals and how much blood they take. Like, it's in the thousands.
Yeah, I actually, it blows my mind every time I look at our data set. We know that moose in central Alberta, for example, and I think it's pretty typical of moose everywhere in southern Canada, from British Columbia all the way to Nova Scotia. Our data show that the average number of ticks on moose are well over 30,000, often 35,000. I've seen many moose with over 80,000 ticks, 100,000 ticks, whereas white-tailed deer will overwinter with 500 ticks, maybe less. Elk are somewhere in the middle. They seem to have about 1,200, 1,500, 2,000 ticks. So, yeah, there's major differences between the well-adapted hosts like deer and the poorly adapted hosts, moose.
How much blood will they lose?
Well, conservatively, it looks to me like calves might have to replace, ticks may take on a calf in a normal year 7 liters, 8 liters, 9 liters of blood. And it looks to me like calves have somewhere between 15 and 18 liters of blood. So calves may be replacing as much as 70-80% of their blood volume. Now, my figures are crude and they might be off, but let's assume that the worst time of year for a moose is March and April, just trying to get through the last part of winter. They're nutritionally deprived. They're just looking forward to spring, which was late this year, and then having to replace, let's just say, 50% of their blood volume in at this time of year is very energetically costly. It takes a lot of energy, even for humans, to produce blood. It's one of the reasons we can't give blood at a blood bank all that often. That is because it takes a fair amount of energy for us to reproduce what's lost in blood volume. So let's just say we have a calf moose that has to replace 50, 60, 70% of its blood volume at the worst time of year for this animal. It's quite a cost, energetically. Pretty hard on moose, these ticks.
Now, I noticed in another one of your slides you had a picture of a rather symbiotic relationship between the moose and magpies. They were sitting there picking the ticks off the backs of the moose. How does that work out?
Magpies in February, March, and April, just about when they're nesting and starting to rear their young in April and May, they actually switch over to this food supply, and the moose are very happy to let them land on their back and feed on them. It's not uncommon to see several magpies feeding on winter ticks, on moose, sometimes on deer in late winter, and the moose just sit there and let them do that. It seems like a pretty interesting one-way street. The magpies get this nice source of protein, these ticks, they're full of blood, and the moose would seem to benefit because these ticks are going to be killed and they won't be producing eggs, which are going to turn into ticks in the next year. So the moose probably said, hey, this is a good deal. But science is seldom black and white, and this system is not black and white. And what I've found is that when the magpies are feeding on these ticks, they rapidly get full. And once they're satiated, then they take live ticks from the back of moose and they cache them in food caches. They'll cache 7, 8, 9, 10 ticks in a cache. And where they cache them, which is down under the snow in the leaf litter, that is exactly where these ticks want to go when they drop off moose to lay eggs. Now, when, like this year, we had quite a bit of snow in March and April when these female ticks are dropping off. When a female tick drops off moose on snow, it has a good chance of dying before it gets a chance to get down in the leaf litter, simply because a lot of snow, and it's a crusted snow, and they just don't get to the right place to lay their eggs. So you would think, well, that's going to break the cycle of the tick. But it turns out that here come these magpies, and their food cache is exactly where the tick wants to be, down in the leaf litter. So the real question is, do magpies come back and eat all the ticks in a cache? They cache the ticks live, so the tick says, great. If they don't come back and get all those ticks, then the tick is in a great place to lay its eggs for the next year. And I really do not know whether magpies go back and get all the food that they've cached and eat it.
Sounds like the moose can't win.
You know, there's an arms race between a host and a parasite. And the host has mechanisms that it uses to try to reduce the number of parasites. And the parasite has mechanisms it uses to remain viable on a host. And I think that's what we're seeing. And I think that the arms race between moose and ticks is early on. And maybe in a couple of hundred years or a couple of thousand years, the system will be much more in balance. And maybe moose and winter ticks will get along much better than they do now. But yeah, right now, it seems like the moose can't win.
Well, it looks like the lectures are going back in. I should let you go. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
That was Dr. Bill Samuel, a professor of biological sciences at the University of Alberta. With all the talk about whether or not Canada should sign the Kyoto Protocol, it was great to hear what some people are actually doing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That opportunity arose at a recent conference in Calgary, sponsored by the Petroleum Technology Alliance of Canada and Alberta's Climate Change Central. A tour around the conference trade show offered a peek at just some of the new technologies and information systems available to help industries curb their emissions.
I'm Patrick Lenhoff, and I work with the Environmental Services Association of Alberta.
What brings you to this conference on greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, at ESA, we're working on a database of companies that have greenhouse gas solutions, so technologies or services that in one way or another improve energy efficiency or reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
What are some of the new technologies that you're aware of through your members?
Well, there's all sorts of things, actually. Some of them are quite simple technologies. Efficient combustion technologies, for example. There are some newer things, almost approaching scientific, science fiction type applications. One example would be light year technologies. They work in the area of nanotechnology. That's one that springs to mind.
Now, what is it that you're trying to achieve?
What we would like to do is give emitters of greenhouse gases a showcase of solutions that they can look at to solve a particular emission problem. So what we're doing is really just taking what's out there already in terms of solutions and giving it a forum to display it in.
Is that one of the problems, is that there's people just don't know what's going on out there?
From my experience, I'd say that's the case, that quite often there are solutions out there that could be used, but they're maybe not well known.
How are you going to go about doing this project?
Well, I can tell you what we've done so far. We've put together a website, the centerpiece of which is a searchable database of companies and their solutions. So the idea is that a company that has a particular emission problem could go to the website and search either by industry or by keyword for a particular product or service.
How can people get hold of you?
They can contact me at the ESA office. It's 1-800-661-9278. And, of course, you'd probably want to take a look at our website, which is www.ghgshowcase.com. And that's where you'll find the database.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much.
My name is Pierre Boileau. I work for Environment Canada, and I manage the Greenhouse Gas Verification Centre.
What is the Greenhouse Gas Verification Centre?
It's a new government program that was announced in Action Plan 2000 by the Government of Canada. It's a program that's intended to help other climate change programs better calculate their greenhouse gas emissions and their greenhouse gas emission reductions.
So are you dealing with software programs?
It's mainly education, actually. We are within a group in Environment Canada called the Greenhouse Gas Division. The Greenhouse Gas Division calculates Canada's greenhouse gas emissions, the whole country's greenhouse gas emissions, and submits those internationally to the Framework Convention on Climate Change. It's one of the agreements that Canada signed on in 1994. So for 10 years, the Greenhouse Gas Division of Environment Canada has been calculating the whole country's emissions, and now we're sort of reaching out to people and trying to educate on the approaches that we use, and hopefully that'll bring people up to speed on how they can go about calculating their own emissions.
I'd hate to be the bean counter on that. How do you go about it?
At the national level, what we use is energy consumption statistics from Stats Canada, from Statistics Canada. We use other things like animal populations and cement production, metals production, iron and steel production data. And we apply what we call emission factors, which are a relationship between the production of a certain thing like fossil fuels or natural gas or something like that, and the amount of emissions that that process produces. And we do that at very high level for large industrial sectors like iron and steel, oil and gas, and that kind of thing. And we do that for the whole country, including all of the emissions that we produce from driving our cars and from farming and forest management and those types of things.
What's your relationship with Alberta companies right now? Is anybody using this, or is this just a way of developing some inroads?
Right now, we've started some consultations with the upstream oil and gas sector here in Alberta, but also in BC and Saskatchewan. There's been an awful lot of work done by the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers and Canadian Gas Association on providing guidance to their members on how they can calculate their greenhouse gas emissions. And what we've begun is a bit of a consultation process to try and take some of that along with the methods that we use and try and come up with a system that will marry the two, I guess, and provide sort of uniform, consistent guidance to the various people who are doing this in the oil and gas industry.
How do you verify these things? Because you are called the Verification Center.
Yeah. It's a bit of a misnomer. Though we're called the Verification Center, we were an outgrowth of a technology verification center. And that center actually originally was verifying environmental technologies and the performance of those technologies. Last year it was decided that there wasn't as much of a market need for that as there was for education. And so our role is less of a verification role as it is an education role. What we're doing on verification is really trying to build into the private sector the capability for consulting firms and auditing firms to become certified as greenhouse gas verifiers. And we want to do that using the existing accreditation system in Canada. There's a normal accreditation system for ISO 14000 verifiers, people who go out and do quality management system verifications. That already exists. And so what we're doing is trying to produce the material, the documents, for a training course that might be used to certify private sector people to become greenhouse gas verifiers and sort of educate them in that process.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Pierre Boileau of Environment Canada. One Edmonton firm that sees a little bit of gold in the greenhouse gas sector is ProEco. Brian Winters of ProEco talked to me about his company's innovations.
We're primarily in the hazardous waste management business, but we've branched off into the cogeneration and greenhouse gas reduction area of the environment business.
So you've got a number of different things on the go. You're here at this conference on greenhouse gas emissions. What are you doing in that area?
We've recently installed a new system for the removal of volatile organic compounds from hazardous waste. And what we do with the compounds that we remove is we generate heat and electricity. And we divert large volumes of waste material that require high temperature incineration to landfill.
How do you actually go about doing that? Because you still have to get the hazardous material out of the stuff, the waste.
We have a patented simultaneous dual fuel internal combustion engine. And what is unique about this is the fact that we can burn waste VOCs, or not burn, but process waste VOCs, as well as use regular fuel at the same time.
So where do those VOCs go?
The VOCs are combusted in the engine, and we have a generator attached to the engine. We generate power with the generator, and then we have a load bank attached to the generator, and we generate heat with that. And we'll be using the heat this fall to heat our facilities and the excess power to run our non-essential services in our warehouse.
Who came up with that brilliant idea?
It was a combination of an idea from a waste management perspective from us and an equipment supplier perspective that is in the soil remediation side of the business that had this unique and patented system, and we saw the possibility of using it as a waste management tool.
Now, what else are you doing?
Well, with the same system, we also are approaching the upstream petroleum industry to look at solution and vent gas, greenhouse gas reduction, and there's also an agricultural sustainability section to this where we can, for example, turn animal waste into methane and use that methane to generate heat and electricity and possibly make some pig farms and chicken farms self-sustainable.
I was just thinking you'd probably have a big market down there in Feedlot Alley.
Yes, I believe there is one. It's more associated with piggeries and chickens than it is with cattle. Their quality, the methane and generation rates are much higher.
What's the market like for your products?
We feel that this is a global product. It has applications in a broad range of industrial, agricultural, and commercial uses. We have interest in North America, in the United States, in Mexico, some interest in Europe already. And that's for the waste management side of this program. Once we get into the flaring and solution vent and agricultural sustainability applications, we'll find it much more global.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Brian Winters of ProEco Corporation of Edmonton. What many people don't realize is that a large percentage of our greenhouse gas emissions come from wastage in the field, where fossil fuels are taken out of the ground and piped to refineries. To demonstrate this to the conference crowd, Meridian Specialties had set up a demonstration with two bottles of water. In one, air was bubbling through at a tremendous rate. The other hardly bubbled at all. Mike Shim explains.
Existing technology, IDPs that bleed 0.35 standard cubic feet of air through water, bubbling through water, and then another technology, Samson 6116 IDPs, that bleed 0.015, or about 1/20, less than 1/20 the amount of air through water.
But what is the problem that you're trying to address?
Well, in the real world, these are quite commonly used in gas well sites, and they're using fuel gas to run them. So you're actually venting unconsumed methane to the atmosphere. And that methane is a greenhouse gas.
Now this one, it's really bubbling away. How does this one compare to the other one where just the odd little bubble is coming out?
Well, it's 20 times more air, or if you're out at the well site, that'd be 20 times more methane being vented to atmosphere. And they do exactly the same job.
Why is it that there's so much of this just wasting away here?
The technology in the ones used today is from the 1950s and 1960s, developed when energy conservation was not a factor. The other unit was developed in the 90s in Europe, where power has always been a factor. It's always been expensive over there, so they lead the way in energy conservation.
If you take that on a larger scale, what's the big picture with this problem?
I know of one company that has 200 of these in one field. If they were to replace all of them with an ultra-low bead positioner, like the Samson material that we sell, equipment, they could save 32,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalents being vented to the atmosphere. That's a significant reduction. They could also save about 800,000 MCF of gas, which is enough to heat a lot of houses.
Now, this isn't the only product that that your company is dealing with. What are some of the other things that you're looking at in terms of making things more environmentally friendly?
Well, we have some solar-powered automated control chokes. They can use a solar-powered array at a remote well site instead of using gas, and then it can be used to control the flow through the gas well. And then we also have a pneumatic, which would be using fuel gas to do the same thing. The one we call our 100% green solution, the other we call our 97% green solution, as in it saved 97% of what existing commonly used equipment would do.
Well, it's rather interesting. What you've said is you've gathered together existing technology, and one of the concerns here is that when we're dealing with greenhouse gas emissions, and the talk has been, well, we have to start researching in that, but it seems like the technology is already there if we would only just put it to use.
Yes, it is. The technology exists today, and it's economically viable. It's basically the same price, cost competitive with what's being bought today. You just have to be willing to change.
How many of these would there be, say, in Alberta or across North America?
Well, there's 70,000 gas well sites in Alberta, approximately. At least half of those have some form of pneumatic control, which we could reduce emissions on. So it's a huge market, and it's increasing by 3,000 to 4,000 a year.
Well, I wish you all the luck.
Thank you very much.
That was Mike Shim of Meridian Specialties. If you're interested in finding out more about greenhouse gas solutions, check the PTAC website at www.ptac.org. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. You can listen to past programs on our new website at innovationalberta.com. The program is sponsored by Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Research Council, the Alberta Conservation Association, Health Sciences Association of Alberta, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, and True North Energy. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.